I think what inspired all of this was really the OG crypto, which is Bitcoin. In Bitcoin, we do proof of work. And the work that the miners do is solve a computationally very difficult math problem that is easy to verify. That's one. And two, they process the transactions. They order the transactions and process them. And in return, they earn the Bitcoin token. So that's the work that they do and the reward that they get. Now, the natural next question is, what is some other work that you can do in the physical world, in the real world, that as a contributor of the work, you can earn tokens for?
Welcome to Good Game, a podcast for crypto insiders with your host, Imran and Chow. Welcome to Good Game, episode 11. Today, we're going to be talking about proof of real work. There's been a lot of talk about it over the past probably 5 to 7 years. We're starting to see some of the early signs of adoption. And not only that, we believe that it could be the next wave of adoption, which we'll touch on in a bit. We'll talk about Helium, HiveMapper, Demo, and try to understand where does the value capture? What are the technical infrastructures that are needed? And then more or less, what is the blueprint for future founders that want to build in the space and how they can replicate the success of Helium and others to think about other areas that they can focus on as they're starting their startup? Chow, thoughts on the above? I know you've been a big proponent of proof of real work. You've written an article with Mohammed Fouda from our team. And so I'm sure you have a lot of thoughts around this.
Yeah, this might be my most contrarian thesis, but I think of proof of physical work as potentially the vertical that will bring the third wave of crypto adoption. When I say the third wave, I mean the first wave being the ICOs in 2017, and the second wave being the NFTs last year and 2 years ago. So both ICOs and NFTs brought a ton of retail users, the mainstream, into this ecosystem. Arguably, you know, Bitcoin did a little bit of it, but Bitcoin was still mostly not really the mainstream. It was the libertarians, the early adopters. So arguably, Bitcoin wasn't the first wave.
Which quickly changed though, right? Like it went from the hands of like end users to like larger enterprises that had a lot of capital.
Exactly. So Bitcoin was actually the thing that brought the institutions to our industry, to this new asset class, but not the mainstream. The mainstream was really ICOs and NFTs. And I think that the third wave is going to be proof of physical work or proof of real work. We're going to use these two terms interchangeably. But why do I say this is a very contrarian thesis? It's because for the longest time, people think that the third wave or the next wave will be brought by gaming and social networks. It sounds pretty straightforward. It sounds pretty intuitive. And I don't necessarily disagree with that thesis, but I want to play devil's advocate on why gaming and social networks are not the next wave. Okay. So if you look at, let's start with gaming. Okay. So today there's hundreds of AAA, AA game studios that are building crypto games. Many of them come from traditional, gaming background or game development background that just got into crypto not long ago. And what a lot of them do is they start as a AAA, AA game, and then they put some of their in-game assets on-chain in the form of NFTs. That could work, but it's just, to me, it feels like it's not very interesting, right?
Yeah, 100%. The thing about gaming that's the hardest to replicate is the cult status, right? The how long do these games last, and how long will they be in the minds of people? If you look at like the studio model, as you mentioned, you need to constantly iterate and build new games that can capture the attention of people. And you need to have a high amount of marketing budget to get to mass adoption for games. So in regards to like finding the lightning in the bottle success for games, it's going to be very capital intensive.
Yeah. And again, like it's possible to build a really good AAA, AA game with a crypto kick in it. But like I'm a 20-year gamer myself. Like I used to play a ton of like FIFA or StarCraft. I play less and less ever since I became a father. But before that, I play a ton of those sports and real-time strategy games. And for me, if you just put some NFTs on-chain, it's not really that interesting for me as a player. I think there might be a very small niche of group of users, like maybe 1% of users that really care about putting their FIFA characters, their players on chain in the form of NFTs. But the vast majority of people like myself don't care about that kind of stuff. The vast majority of people care about the gameplay.
Let's play devil's advocate on that one. Mm-hmm. There's a thesis around, and I hear this a lot, which is like Fortnite and Roblox and the new generation of gamers who are the 12 to 15 year olds are more or less buying skins to upgrade their avatar or yep. in-game assets. And so some of the gaming proponents in crypto say, well, NFTs could be replaced with these in-game assets. What are your thoughts on that? I have a quick thought, which is, you know, they work fine now. Why need to replace with NFTs?
I have a quick analogy that is in production and has been in production for a while, which is Reddit and their NFTs. Mm. So the analogy that I'm drawing is, so you have these AAA games that are launching their in-game assets in the form of NFTs, and then you have Reddit, who recently, or several months ago, launched their avatars in the form of NFTs. How many people actually care about that? How many people actually care about owning their avatars in the form of NFTs? Have you claimed your own Reddit avatar in the form of NFTs?
I think
there's a small niche, like hardcore people who care about that, but the vast majority don't.
Yes. Well, people could claim their avatar NFT, and I think there's some incentives behind it to do it, right? And I think the speculative nature of NFTs is what, at least the first, you know, period of when the claims happened with Reddit, where we saw an all-time high in transactions conducted on Polygon.
Yep.
But then it simmered down, and now I don't think it's as active as it was back then.
Yeah. I mean, by the way, that happens all the time with new product launches. You always see a spike, and then it dies down over time. But my point being, launching in-game assets in the form of NFTs appeal to probably a small number of people. It doesn't really appeal to the mainstream. So that's what I'm seeing in the in the state of crypto gaming today. Now, there is a group of game projects that are very interesting to me, something that we wrote about almost a year ago with Will on our team, which is the fully on-chain games. Okay, so these are the games that put, number one, all the on-chain states, and number two, all the on-chain logic, all the game logic and states on-chain. Okay, so these are what we call on-chain games. Why are they interesting? It's because they fundamentally enable composability. So composability between players, composability between games. What gave us this idea was really DeFi Summer 2020, because DeFi Summer was, in fact, the first mass adopted crypto game. You have all these people around the world playing this one speculative game. And within this game, there's several types of composability going on. One is the protocols built on top of each other. That's the composability between the sub-games. And then there's players building bots to trade those assets. And that's the composability between the player and the protocol, between the player and the game. So DeFi Summer was actually the first fully on-chain game. This is what inspired us to start thinking about fully on-chain games. So for me, fully on-chain games are very interesting, are fundamentally interesting, because they enable new behaviors. That's the composability between players and between games. However, there is a problem with fully on-chain games. And that is the fact that today the blockchains are simply not scalable enough. So back to napkin calculation. If you Google the top Web2 games, AAA games in the world right now, and you look at their daily active users, the top games today, they have around 100 million daily active users, order of magnitude. So let's assume that each player does 100 actions per day, which to me is a fairly conservative estimate. Like you do all these things, you do all these clicks in the AAA game. I would assume that on average, it's way more than 100, but let's assume it's 100 clicks, actions per day that are fully on-chain. So 100 state changes, 100 transactions per day on-chain. So if you do that, if you do this multiplication, and you divide that by the number of seconds per day, you're going to get 100,000 transactions per second. So in other words, if you have a fully on-chain game that's totally mainstream today, that 100 million people play, it requires 100,000 TPS Name one blockchain that can support that today. Just one game. There is none. One game will clog the entire blockchain. So that's the issue with fully on-chain game today, is that our chains are not scalable enough for that.
There are some areas of research that are going on, like if you think about Starkware's layer 2, layer 3 system, you know, app chain as a model, right? Roll up as a service. But even then, I feel like that doesn't fully solve the 100,000 transactions per second.
That's right.
Problem that we
have. So we've gone a really long tangent now. I want to really quickly touch on the second, just going back to the original thesis that of playing the devil's advocate on why gaming and social are not going to be the next wave, may not be the next wave. So let's touch on the social aspect, the social networks aspect. Imran, when was the last time you came across a crypto social network and you were like, this is really interesting, instead of like, man, this is just yet another Twitter clone?
None so far.
Because they all look like Twitter and existing Web2 social networks.
Yeah.
So my issue with that is, like, if you clone Twitter or whatever, I think it's possible to get a decent amount of success. You may be able to really appeal to a small group of users. But there has never been a single case in history where you copy an existing big successful product and achieve mainstream adoption with 6 billion people. Okay, like a world-changing product has to be something that's fundamentally different, that enables fundamentally new behaviors. The next Google will look nothing like Google. The next Facebook will look nothing like Facebook, right? So almost by definition, the first crypto network that will bring this space to the mainstream needs to be something so fundamentally different, so ridiculous, potentially even laughable to a lot of people. It may seem like a total toy. It may seem like a total, like, a game or whatever, but it needs to be fundamentally different from existing very successful products. And two, the social networks suffer the same problems that the games suffer, which is scalability of blockchains. In fact, probably orders of magnitude worse, because imagine the amount of messages that we send to each other, that we post on Twitter across a billion people. That's even more TPS required for blockchains.
Well, let's play devil's advocate on this one too.
Sure.
Lens protocol, it's fundamentally different, right? There are some that are, you know, client first, that offer an experience that's similar to Twitter, but on the back end, they're essentially building a protocol. And that protocol could be designed in a way where others can build other types of clients that can create different types of experiences for their users.
Yep.
But the key infrastructure here is like the DID, right? The decentralized identity infrastructure that is providing outside developers to capture this identity data and then build products around it. You have Farcaster, and then you have Lens. Lens, interestingly, is going completely decentralized, right? So instead of building a client-first model, they're building a model where they allow any developer to build on all the infrastructure is built out for its users. So users can use any of these clients, sign up, and then they're creating like a user profile, and that user profile could be in an NFT form, and it could be modular, composable, etc. A couple of days ago, I looked at the user count for how many profiles have been created. They hit like 112,000. Not bad. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the growth, it's like growing pretty fast. So the question is, what's driving that growth? And is that going to be the gateway for the third wave that you talked about? Or is it going to be? Yeah. So
again, this goes back to the question of, Is this enabling fundamentally new behavior? I think the crypto social networks today, they enable fundamentally new behavior for developers.
Yes.
But not for the consumers yet. That's my issue with the current landscape. And
got it.
Again, these new clients might appeal to a small group of hardcore people, but I find it very hard for it to go fully mainstream to 6 billion people if you don't enable fundamentally new behavior for consumers. So to summarize, both games and social networks today in crypto suffer these two problems. One is enabling new behavior, and two, the scalability of blockchains. And we spent 15 minutes talking about this because this is very important to our thesis as to why proof of physical work might be the one vertical that will bring crypto to the mainstream. It's because, number one, proof of physical work does enable really interesting new behavior. Okay. So you're going to install a Helium hotspot or install a dash cam in your car to capture road images, right? And while doing that, you can earn tokens. This is fundamentally new. This has never happened before. You can earn tokens immediately in your wallet, and these tokens might appreciate over time. So this is a fundamentally new behavior. And two, all this involves on-chain is transfer of tokens. So it's not that many transactions, and those transactions are not that computationally expensive. So in my mind, today, the blockchains are actually good enough to support this new use case, which basically only involves transactions.
So the thesis here fundamentally is, you know, we are beholden to our scaling solutions. Mm-hmm. And based on that, products that are able to provide value for end users are susceptible to how fast the chain is going to run in terms of transactions. And gaming, social, there isn't anything that's differentiated. And gaming obviously requires high throughput. And right now, proof of physical work could be the right model because technically a lot of it's off-chain, right?
Yep.
And so like Helium devices are off-chain. Hive Mapper devices are off-chain. And really they use crypto as a way to record a collection of the data and then paying out that for that data.
That's right.
Makes sense to me. And maybe this is probably a good segue into where this is all going and what is proof of physical work.
Yeah. We spoke for like 15 minutes, 20 minutes without defining what proof of physical work is. But what is your definition, Imran?
I think proof of physical work is pretty much doing verifiable work off-chain, recording it on-chain, and then getting paid in tokens for that. It could be in the form of data. You can contribute in the form of data, which is the most popular way. There are other forms that are coming into light, but I'd say data input is the most important right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, for me, the definition is pretty much the same. The only thing I would add is, what inspired all of this? I think what inspired all of this was really the OG crypto, which is Bitcoin. In Bitcoin, we do proof of work, and the work that the miners do is solve a computationally very difficult math problem that is easy to verify. That's one. And two, they process the transactions. They order the transactions and process them. And in return, they earn the Bitcoin token. So that's the work that they do and the reward that they get. Now, the natural next question is, what is some other work that you can do in the physical world, in the real world, that as a contributor of the work, you can earn tokens for? And this is what led to the idea of Helium, Hive Mapper, and so on and so forth.
Yep. There are a few interesting elements that proof of physical work can enable that people haven't really thought about yet, which is being able to build infrastructure faster. Like, let's take Helium as an example, or even Hive Mapper. You're able to deploy millions of cameras across the world to actively map out the different streets across the globe. If you think about what Apple does today, sorry, Google and Apple, they spend probably every 14 months where they reimage the street data. And so that's like every 14 months. And this is like in Silicon Valley where they live, where they're based out of. Mm-hmm. The average street in the US is probably 3 to 4 years. The average street globally that are popular are about every 5 years. So if you think about the freshness of that data, it's pretty stale. And like, you know, if you think about data generally, we want, you know, fresh data always. And so getting stale data, is it going to be helpful in regards to scale and the types of opportunities that you could bring about for the third-party ecosystem?
Just to put this into context, I think Kyle Simon shared some data about, was it Hive Mapper?
Do you have the data? So over 186,000 kilometers have been mapped. So 115,000 miles only within a 2.5 month period.
And that's what, like, assuming that they focus exclusively in the US, that's like 5 to 10% order of magnitude of the total distance of roads in the US.
Yeah.
In 3 months.
Which is pretty insane. In context, like, it's like driving around the world 4.5 times in 2.5 months. So it gives you an idea of like scale.
So by the way, Helium started as a network for IoT devices. And in terms of scale, rapid scale, touching on the concept of rapid scale, I'm just quoting something that Tushar wrote maybe a year ago. The entire US telecommunications industry has 417,000 cell towers. And estimates for the total number of cell towers in the world range from 3 million to 8 million. The Helium network has achieved a similar level of scale in just 30 months, which is pretty insane. Now, I think there's a little bit of exaggeration in all of this because a Helium hotspot is not comparable to a cell tower in terms of scale and the cost behind it. But it does show, these numbers do show how fast a proof of physical work can scale within a short period of time.
And the level of granularity it can offer is the other thing that these devices can do. Being able to map out a side street, like alleys, being able to get internet access in rural areas, areas where traditional infrastructure can't touch, can now be hyper-localized for areas that are not being served today. And that's like kind of the element of why Starlink became popular, right? And that's how most things become very popular, is they start out in this like niche areas, and then the popularity becomes more so apparent so that it starts to scale into like other areas of opportunities. So hyperlocalization, and obviously, as you mentioned earlier, which is cost effectiveness, or of how cheap the infrastructure it is to roll out. Just to throw out some numbers, it costs T-Mobile and other like wireless network providers upwards of $10 billion just to bid on spectrum that are licensed by the FCC, just to acquire these licenses so that they could run spectrum, so they could operate the spectrum, so that they can build wireless infrastructure on top of it. And so there is no way another wireless provider can enter this business, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so in terms of startups, there's no startups in this space because it's heavily dominated by monopolies, and there's just no way for others to enter into the space. And then if you think about the cost to operate startups on top of this internet layer. So the reason why IoT devices, I don't know if you remember, but IoT was like a big fad in the early 2000s. So much so it inspired IOTA.
The trinary or whatever it's called, the blockchain or whatever.
I don't know, but I just remember that every wallet had a backdoor attack, and I think every wallet got drained on IOTA.
That's right.
Rest in peace. Where I was going with this is IoT hasn't still taken off yet, and there's a reason for that. And this kind of talks about what Helium is building, which I wanted to touch on. So Helium started pretty early, like 4 years after Bitcoin started. It was started by Amir Haleem. Sean, if you know Sean, he was one of the, Sean Fanning, he was one of the co-founders of Napster. So that peer-to-peer infrastructure was like infused based on his background.
Yeah.
And he ultimately coined the term like activity mining. And he said, like, why don't we use Bitcoin's model as a way to incentivize people to run these devices at their homes? Mm-hmm. And it ended up being a hit around 2019. They scaled this out.
So just to be clear, they started as a pure, you know, infrastructure company, like non-crypto related.
That's right.
And then several years later, they saw the opportunity of using crypto to incentivize the bootstrapping phase of the network.
Yes. And this is the birth of proof of physical work. Like this dialogue between like Sean Fanning, Amir Haleem, and the other co-founder, Sean. Mm-hmm. And they were sitting in a room and they're like, how do we get people to run hotspots in their house? There's no way. And Sean Fanning said, he said a funny joke. He said, what if we could get these things to mine Bitcoin? And that led to them thinking about tokens, their own layer one. And that kind of gave birth to the proof of physical industry. Mm-hmm. And so that's like the early days. Now, the next area, which is like, how do we get these devices to run in people's houses? And what types of infrastructure can we enable to do so? And so they built something called the these IoT hotspots, where people can actually mine Helium tokens, and then they can send out a internet signal, and that would ultimately provide this type of coverage. But the problem with this is that for people that are running IoT devices, it costs a lot of money to use the internet from traditional cellular coverage because of the battery.
That's right.
It drains the battery. So they developed something called a LoRaN.
Long range,
wide area network. Yeah. That's right. Do you want to touch anything on that?
I'm not a hardware, network kind of guy, but just to give you the high level, there's many different types of network protocols, right? Like there's Wi-Fi, there's 5G, 4G, 3G. These are cellular networks. There's Bluetooth that you use to connect devices across a short distance. And there is LoRaWAN.
LoRaWAN.
Long-range wide area network, which is primarily used to connect IoT devices. So what would be an example of that is, remember this company called Lime? Like they do like scooters, bikes,
yes,
and stuff like
rest
that.
Rest in peace.
So they would install a sensor on their scooters, and the company itself would communicate with the scooters over this LoRaWAN network, as opposed to other types of networks that I mentioned before. And the only reason for that is LoRaWAN, by definition, it's designed for long-range communication, and it's very, very, very cheap. Like using like Wi-Fi, like traditional internet, these things are very expensive. These are too expensive for the specific use cases that it had. So LoRaWAN is a network specifically designed to connect IoT devices.
And it's open. So it's not like something that they own. It's an open protocol that they design. And there's one more really cool thing about LoRaWAN, which is OpenLNS. Which is Open LoRaWAN Network Server. And what that does is it's like an Oracle system that identifies and authenticates devices one time to the network. So the entire LoRaWAN network knows this device, and it can transfer internet connection from one device to the other without having to log out and log back in, which is pretty important into what they're doing next. So what they're doing next is, you may have heard the news where now they've announced their 5G hotspot mining infrastructure. So essentially, you can run a 5G hotspot network in your house. And so essentially what users can do is they can spit out a 5G network signal, and this 5G network signal provides cellular coverage. So previously you had a traditional Helium IoT device. This Helium IoT device would just send out an internet signal. This new 5G hotspot allows you to send out a cellular internet connection that's very similar to the spectrum network that our phones use today, which is, you know, 3.5 gigahertz, et cetera. And so what this enables is ultimately someone can build a wireless internet carrier on this network across the US without having to build out the spectrum licensing and the telecom infrastructure that's needed to operate a wireless carrier. I mean, I had to research to find out about this, but this should be much bigger news than it is already.
Yeah. So just to be clear, Helium, they started as an IoT network, and then now they want to do a new type of network, which is the 5G.
That's right.
A quick rundown.
So now they're selling SIM cards that you can buy today. You pay $10 and you get 20 gigs of service. It's also partnered with T-Mobile. And so, you know, obviously Helium isn't available everywhere. So whenever there's areas where there isn't coverage, and T-Mobile provides it. But the goal is over time, Helium will provide all the services. And then it really changes the way we think about protocols, right? And I think you and I chatted about this before. And here's a great example of our thesis. Back in 2016 or 17, when 0x launched, if you remember 0x, they were an open protocol that allows anyone to build a DEX for any type of liquidity, right? Mm-hmm. And so you had all of these founders that started to build their own DEXs for different types of tokens. Long story short, it didn't end up working out because, you know, ultimately you have to build a product that brings people to the masses, right? So then they ended up building Matcha, which was a first party app that brought on more users, and that enabled the third party ecosystem to thrive. Mm-hmm. Similar in that nature, Helium is doing the same thing. So remember, you and I had chatted a couple weeks ago about demand and how hard it is to build demand. The supply side is very easy, right? You incentivize people to operate a device and they get tokens.
Well, it's not very easy. It's just easier than on the supply side. You still need to do a lot of financial modeling,
of course,
all that stuff, and it's very hard to get it right on the first attempt. But yes, it is easier than the demand side.
Yeah. And the demand side is where I think every industry in crypto the problem they're facing is the demand side, right?
Yeah.
So you have token sinks and you have all these other areas where you could drive more value back to a token.
By the way, in case this is not clear, when we say that the supply side and the demand side, the supply means the issuance of tokens, how tokens are minted in proof of physical work. Tokens are minted to reward those people who do the work, who contribute work to the network. And the demand side means what can you use the token for? Mm-hmm. Well, in the case of proof of physical work or Helium in particular, you can use tokens to buy network bandwidth. But it doesn't work exactly like that. In the case of Helium, the demand actually comes from burning the tokens, right? So whenever you use the network, you burn tokens. But mathematically, it's pretty much equivalent. So this is what we mean by supply and demand.
And just to add to that, on the demand side, it's actually very interesting. If you read Matt Levine's, like his newsletter, Money Stuff, he talked about proof of physical work. And it was pretty funny because I read through it and it pretty much said, yeah, you get people to run these nodes or devices and they get paid in tokens. It's like a giant Ponzi scheme. But the hope is, you know, that more people come than they leave, and then the Ponzi may not be a Ponzi anymore. But then he ended up talking about, you know, like who needs internet access in a rural area? How big of a customer base is that?
Yeah.
And the demand side has been plagued with like, how is the demand going to come? Where is it going to come? And ultimately, we're giving out too much token and there's not enough people that are going to use the network.
Yeah, but like the demand for Helium in rural areas, that's not the market that Helium is going after, from what I see. Like the internet in the rural areas, that's Elon Musk, that's Starlink.
That's Starlink.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, like Helium was the early days, right? Now, I think there's a more concrete plan of where they're going next. With the launch of 5G hotspots to become a cellular provider. They're also launching a couple new networks on top of all of this. So now you have this internet layer that sits on top of the world, right? What can you build on top that can enable new things? Well, you have 5G network for cellular coverage. And by the way, when you mine these hotspot tokens, they come in the form of a different token called mobile. And mobile could be burned for HNT. Then you have VPN service. So people can, in the future, run VPN infrastructure and they can get VPN tokens that would burn for hotspot.
So VPN would be a different type of network. So they start with IoT network and then 5G network and then VPN network and probably CDN. Some other types CDN. Of network in the future.
Yeah. So that gives you a highlight of where demand is coming from, how they think about demand, and how are they going to monetize over time, and how all of this value will accrue to HNT holders.
Yeah.
There's one more thing they did that I think really changes the narrative of AppChain thesis, which is that they moved out of their own layer one, and now they're building on Solana, which just got passed not too long ago.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for it is a couple reasons, which I think is going to be very important for future founders that are building in this space. One is, they don't have to dedicate developers, hardcore developers, to continue to maintain and manage the layer one. It frees up incentives so that they can use incentives as a way to spur adoption on the demand side. And three is, it gives them more emphasis on composability. So they believe like the token in itself could be used on exchanges, it could use for DeFi, and et cetera. So those were like the three primary reasons why they moved away from their own layer one to building on Solana.
Yeah. I would say that the primary reason is probably the DeFi part, is that people, when the moment they earn tokens, they can sell it, and vice versa. This is somewhat different topic, but the integration with existing DeFi is one of the key arguments against AppChain thesis. But anyway, we can talk about it on a later episode.
I mean, it'd be fun to talk about it now, but yeah. Good.
I just want to touch on the demand side. So when I did the research into Helium, HiveMapper, and even an alliance company called Spexy. By the way, what they do is they use tokens to incentivize like drones, like DJI, drone operators, to capture aerial images in order to build a 3D Google Earth kind of product. So when I did research into the demand side for all these different proof of physical work companies, what I realized that, at least in the early days, the demand side mainly comes from enterprises rather than consumers. So for example, as I mentioned before, in the case of Helium, some of the early users of the IoT network are companies like Lime. And in the case of HiveMapper, obviously they tried to build this decentralized Google map. And obviously their first customers are the government logistics companies who use that data through an API. who buy that data through an API. And then in the case of Spexy, we know them very well, and their first customers are the local governments who want those 3D aerial images. So I don't know if it's a coincidence, but it's very interesting that the majority of the main proof of physical work products today have enterprises, institutions, governments, rather than consumers as their first customers on the demand side. Whereas the supply side is the individuals, is the consumers, right? Like the individuals like you and me running hotspots, driving a car, or operating a drone. So this two-sided network, at least in the early stage, seems to be a two-sided network where the supply side is consumers and the demand side is enterprises.
I think there's a reason for that. And I think it's primarily like, what products can you build that can be bundled in a way that can offer like a great service and discounts in a way that's going to keep them using your product from a monetization perspective? And so you're starting to see this starting to come into fruition where Helium is creating its own demand, first party demand, by building out its own cellular network, right? Its own like cell phone service, Helium cell phone service. Mm-hmm. And so I do think now that's changing, and that's going to change by what services that it can offer to its consumers. Can it be packaged in a consumerized way where they can start to sell the service and start to retain some value from that perspective? Which I think is the right way. You saw Xerox, as I mentioned earlier, Xerox did this with Xerox Protocol, now Matcha. You're seeing other protocols like Farcaster that build out its own protocol, but now it's building out its own client. So I do think there is a first-party strategy that's important for the protocol to thrive in the long run.
Yeah. Speaking of that, there is a very interesting thing to note, which is that obviously when you operate a proof of physical network, there is some hardware that's involved. So in the case of Helium, it's hotspots. In the case of Spexy, it's the drones. In the case of Hivemapper, it's the dash cam. It's the cameras. And interestingly enough, all of them, except for Spexy, most of them start with a first-party built hardware. So they all start building their own hardware or working with a very close partners to build the hardware in order to have full control over the standardization of the hardware. You don't want to allow any random hardware to participate in the network, right? Because that will, first, it may not just work, and two, you might disrupt the network. It's like, in the case of Bitcoin mining, you don't want to, not every type of hardware will work for Bitcoin mining. Okay, so they all start with first party hardware, but at some point with Helium, and this was the Helium HIP-19, Helium Improvement Proposal 19, where they allowed third party hardware manufacturers to produce hardware and to participate in the network. So they whitelisted maybe 20, 30 third-party hardware providers to participate in the network. And it turns out that this transition from first-party hardware to third-party hardware is the single most important thing that they've done in terms of increasing the coverage, global coverage for the network. Because all of a sudden, you have 30 different types of hardware instead of just one that's compatible with the network. So a lot of people can participate.
And you're enabling a whole new sales force, right? That's selling your product to other users that you can't touch originally, which I think is very important in terms of a mass adoption. Like to touch on that, you have, I'd say at least 20 or 25 startups that are using this as a way to implement it in their own hardware in terms of being able to sell it to their own customers. So there's companies that are doing agriculture data, right? Being able to install these devices on tractors to manage tractors. You have air quality devices that are being built as a way to manage air or to get a sense of air quality. Mm-hmm. And so you're starting to see like a whole third-party ecosystem being built on this internet infrastructure. They're enabling new things, and they're all just using the standard that you mentioned, the hardware standard, and that's enabling more and more people using the Helium network in the long run.
There's a couple of very important topics I want to talk to you about. One is we've talked about all these different networks, but we haven't really answered the question of why do we want to use tokens in bootstrapping these networks? Because for the longest time, for the past 10 years, most projects that did involve a token turn out to be ones that actually never needed a token. Tokens turn out to be just a way for them to monetize their work. but it was never absolutely necessary for the network itself. So I really want to talk to you about this. So Imran, what do you think, why are tokens so important? Because you and I have been critiques of the use of tokens in the vast majority of early stage crypto projects. Mm-hmm. But my view is that for proof of physical work projects, tokens are actually absolutely necessary. In fact, they're part of the product itself. They are the product. And it's mm-hmm. absolutely paramount to prioritize token design over everything else. So yes. Why do we use tokens in proof of physical work?
I'm going to point to the interview link that you sent me of there's a proof of physical panel. And Ariel, who's the founder of Hivemapper, said this very clearly. And I think it put into all perspective. First is, like, if you look at Waze as an example, Waze, people contribute to the Waze network. They provide like crowdsource data so people can see, you know, if there's a cop ahead of time or if there's an accident, et cetera. And so people are already actively contributing to this network. And people are doing this just because they want to help others out, right? Mm-hmm. There isn't no other way. Mm-hmm. And what ended up happening was he gave this clear example of when Waze got acquired by Google, the people that contributed to the network didn't get anything in return. It was primarily mm-hmm. the developers that built the product. Mm-hmm. And so you have this clear incentive misalignment where the developers are getting paid for the work of all the work that contributors are doing. That's like one, right? Two is being able to get freshness of that data in a way that creates clear incentive alignment, and using crypto as a ledger to make the payments is probably the best use case, right? So being able to track the contribution work for the end user and then mm-hmm. being able to facilitate the payments for the end user makes a lot of sense. And the final point is, like, if the network grows because of the support that they're offering, then why not be rewarded for it in the long run? Another example I'll give you is that Hivemapper actually used cash to pay their users. And it turns out the experience was very adversarial, which is, well, I'm only getting paid this much for the work that I'm doing. What's the point of me doing the work? Mm-hmm. And so there was this like big misalignment in regards to how contributors are contributing to a network and then what is Hivemapper getting. Here's another example, which is Uber. Uber drivers are pissed all the time. In fact, I had a Uber driver send me a pitch the other day of why Uber drivers are not getting the benefits that others are getting because mm-hmm. they're putting in so much work, not enough time, not enough money, and too many fees on top. This could be solved using tokens, right? Because now you have value that accrues to the entire network and everyone has the same upside as the founders do. And then over time, they feel like they have this ownership that they wouldn't if it was just like a adversarial relationship, which is like person A pays person B. Mm-hmm. So that's like a few things that I think about when I think about that.
So if I could summarize, one is the expectation of profit because tokens are volatile and they may appreciate over time and people love that. And for the longest time, people argue against the speculative nature of crypto. I think we should just embrace it. The speculative nature of crypto actually helps bootstrap a whole new network. So one is the expectation of profit. Two is the psychological part, which is they feel like owners rather than just employees or contractors, mm-hmm. which is in the case of Uber. And three is the transparency, where they feel like they will not be cheated by the company. I think by far the biggest value proposition is the speculative nature, is the expectation mm-hmm. of future profit for the vast majority of people. There's probably a small group of people who are hardcore supporters who want to feel like they're owners, etc. But for the vast majority of people, it's the ability to make money by doing this work. So that's the value proposition of tokens for users. But I also want to point out a few important value propositions of the tokens for the network itself, for the operator mm-hmm. of the network, right? So it's, you have users of network, but you also have the think of the network as an entity itself. So the first value proposition, we already touched on this, which is the rapid scale. We can bootstrap a whole new network within a very short period of time. And two is that it's actually possible that proof of physical work networks are cheaper than their Web2 traditional counterparts. And the reason why I say that is because when you install a dashcam to participate in the Hivemapper network, for example, you don't need to buy a car in order to participate in the network and earn tokens. You probably are someone who already own a car, and all you do is to install a dash cam. And you're probably already driving around. You don't drive for the sake of earning tokens. You're already driving around to, you know, go grocery shopping or whatever. So this upfront cost is basically taken care of. Yep. You don't need to pay anything upfront. You're already a driver. You're already driving.
It's passive.
So in the case of Google Map, for example, is the total opposite. Google needs to spend all that money to buy cars and to install cameras and to hire drivers to drive around specifically for mapping out the world, the roads. So Google actually incurs a very high upfront cost. And the situation is the same for Helium, for example. So when you are a network operator, a traditional network operator, you need to build all these towers. You need to invest a ton of money into owning the land, the real estate, and all that stuff. But as an operator in the Helium network, chances are you are already a owner of a piece of land or you're a renter. So that cost is taken care of. So you're not paying anything extra to be a Helium operator. So that upfront cost is also taken care of in the case of Helium. So in both cases, and this is probably true in the case of Spexy as well.
Like and Demo.
The DJI, you already own the DJI. You're not buying DJI for the sake of earning tokens in the Spexy network. So in all these cases, the upfront capital expenditure cost has been made. You're not incurring any new costs. And that's why proof physical work can actually be cheaper than the traditional networks.
And even if there's an upfront cost, that the payback period on that is relatively low compared to anything else. And so I've seen users buy multiple devices as a way to kind of scale out how they want to react to these types of token incentives. And so what would a world look like in the future? Could like Uber drivers all automatically, if Uber drivers are classified as, you know, drivers for Uber because of the lawsuits that they have coming, could Uber use this as a way to monetize future drivers in the long run? You never know. It's a very interesting concept of mass adoption using large networks and then being able to accumulate these tokens in a way that could benefit a larger enterprise.
Imran, the final topic I want to talk to you about is, I guess for future founders that want to build in this space. So this proof of physical work, this particular vertical is very special because it requires a combination of domain expertise in two different areas. One is crypto and two is some kind of domain expertise in the traditional like networking or data or whatever, right? And by the way, some of the most interesting innovations throughout history of humanity comes from the cross-pollination of two seemingly uncorrelated independent fields. And this is the case for proof of physical work. But as a result, this creates challenges for founders because you need expertise in two different domains. And so I want to talk to you about some of the lessons we could learn from existing experiments like Helium so that future founders can learn from it. What do you think? What are some of the lessons you've seen that can be helpful for future founders?
I think the first is this is a long journey. It's a very long journey. Like if you think about Helium as an example, Amir started this around 2014, and it's almost like 9 years now as an example. And now they're just starting to get the demand side figured out. And he says that he reiterates to other founders, this is a very long game. Two is understanding who your contributors are and how do you target them. And so obviously contributors can be those that run infrastructure for you in return for tokens and what their value proposition is going to be within your network. And so the value proposition could be like, do they get a vote? How active should they be? How should the tokens be designed in a way that could steer more involvement in the community, et cetera? Three is understand like this is a two-sided marketplace at the end of the day, right? Focusing on just the supply side, which Chao mentioned is the user side, is one important element of building out the network. But the demand side is also very important and start to think about how they can get involved in the space. And so that's like number three. And then the final point I'll touch on is third-party ecosystem, which I think is very important in order to spur adoption in the space. Helium, Demo, HiveMapper, they're all thinking about how developers can use their networks in a way that can build really cool stuff that could bring in more adoption to the space. And so those are like the four things that I think about if we want to think of like the blueprint for proof of physical work. I mean, there are many more, but like those are the four that I think about.
Just to touch on your last point, the third-party ecosystem, again, going back to the history of some of the existing proof of physical network projects, it's something that you probably don't want to spend too much time in the at the outset of the project. It's something that you should start thinking about once you have a critical mass of users. Like initially, you still want to own everything in order to move fast and experiment fast and fail fast. But at some point, you want to involve like the third-party manufacturers, third-party developers, et cetera. But that comes at a later stage.
And I think one more, like I wouldn't say mistake, but like that I think Helium made early on was like focusing too much on a token and giving out too much incentives, right? Yep. When there wasn't enough demand to match the supply that was available. I think that's also an important point.
I think this is probably one of the most critical lessons for every founder. Probably every founder in every vertical, but certainly more pronounced in proof of physical work, which is that you will never get your token design right on the first attempt. No matter how hard you try, no matter how much financial modeling you do, no matter how much you prepare, no matter how many independent pairs of eyes to look at and criticize your initial draft, you will never get it right. And you should expect to change it in production and to experiment with new models in production. Helium has changed their models multiple times and it's still changing, right? The latest iteration from what I've seen is creating this two new sub-tokens, one mobile, like the mobile token for the 5G network and the other token for the IoT network, and then having the HNT token backing both under the hood. So it's still changing. And that's the expectation that every founder in this space should have. You'll never get it right and continue to experiment in production. There's a couple of lessons I learned that are very specific to proof of physical work, which is that first, the pricing on the consumer side, on the demand side, basically, is very hard to get right. You have to do a lot of financial modeling. Like basically, how much do you pay? How many tokens do you pay in order to access the network, in order to use the network? It's very hard to get it right on the first attempt as well. This has been the case with Helium, and probably many other proof of physical network projects are facing the same challenge. And two is that onboarding users into this system, into our network, can be a challenge. So for example, like when you install a dash cam, where do you position dash cam? How do you install it? That kind of stuff might be really simple for you as a founder because you think about it all day, every day. But for a mainstream user, they need clear instructions. It might not be clear, totally clear to them. They need very clear instructions on how to install the hardware. I think this is a fairly easy problem to solve, but it's something that people should keep in mind.
I want to touch on the cost for a second, your first point that you just mentioned. I wanted to throw this out earlier, but I just remembered. The cost is pretty insane in terms of like if you think about what T-Mobile offers versus Helium. This is just a pure example of like how much there's a cost benefit to consumers or enterprise. Like an example is like T-Mobile offers an eSIM card, 5 gigs for $20, whereas you could get the same amount for $20, you can get 10 gigs. So you can get double the internet for the same cost. So that gives you I just want to throw out an example of how much there is a cost benefit by running a decentralized infrastructure using proof of physical work and how that could be competitive against larger enterprises that you're competing with in the long run.
Yeah. And probably a lot of the cost saving comes from the fact that the incumbent networks or the incumbent companies are they're monopolies or duopolies, and they have a lot of pricing power. So a lot of cost probably just comes from that fact alone.
Exactly. Look, I know we touched on a lot with proof of physical work, especially on blueprints of like what a founder should do. What are some areas that you're excited about next? Like, I think there are so much areas where we can use this blueprint as a way to establish new industries. And I know you and Mohamed Fouda wrote an article about this, and maybe we could dive into some of those topics just to see what can be enabled in the future and or inspire future founders to build in these areas.
Yeah.
I'll throw out a couple from your article, and then we could talk about it. Mm-hmm. One is health data sharing. Mm-hmm. Second is regenerative finance, decentralized energy grid, talent marketplace, and decentralized voice over IP. The one that I'm most excited about is health data, but go ahead.
That's right. The one I'm personally most excited about is using tokens to incentivize individuals to contribute health data. And the problem that this tries to solve is twofold. One is that today, all of our health data is extremely siloed. So you go to like 10 different doctors, 5 different hospitals, they all own a part of your personal data, health data. But there's no single place where all these data sets are together in one place for scientific research, for drug development. So one of the key impediments to progress in health science and certainly science in general is the lack of data. Mm-hmm. There's just not enough data to do clinical trials, to do research, preliminary research. And we want a central repository of all these data sets so that people can conduct research with statistical significance. So that's the first problem. The second problem is privacy. I think it's possible to leverage technologies like zero-knowledge proofs to actually enhance the privacy of your personal data. So right now, like I don't know if you've done like 23andMe.
I haven't.
You haven't.
I'm scared about the data piece.
Exactly. So like, imagine you give out your genetic data to this one company called 23andMe. The genetic data may not sound that important today, but I am sure that in 10, 20 years, this is going to be the single most important piece of information that anyone can know about you. I don't want a centralized company to own that important of a data set about me. So what I want instead is I contribute data to this distributed ledger, and I have the right to grant access to third-party researchers, and nobody else can use that data.
And their work could culminate in more incentives, right?
Exactly.
And so you're empowering this. And then we could go deep into this, which is like, you know, I think like there isn't enough funding for researchers today. And so the types of data sets that are available is very limited. The amount of funding in health and clinical trials is very limited. The amount of R&D is limited. So you could completely reverse that by creating some sort of incentive that allows people to pay for this service. And more users are incentivized to building out interesting new concepts around the data they get from us.
That's exactly right. So like, as a user, I want to contribute my data in a privacy-enhancing way and earn tokens. It's as simple as that. And the one blockchain I want to call out, and this is a side note, is Oasis. I believe that they're doing some very interesting work to find founders in this space, like at the intersection of crypto and health science. And I've just met a couple of founders in that ecosystem, but it's a very small ecosystem. And I would be very excited to talk to more founders from that ecosystem.
It turns out that people that are building in the cross of crypto and like health and crypto and X, there are very, very limited amount of people that you can actually find to do this, that understand both crypto and like domain experts in these specific sectors.
So typically, what we recommend is you have two or more co-founders, and one of them is a crypto expert, and the other one is a expert in the other domain, right?
That's right.
Health or solar or whatever. And both co-founders are intellectually curious enough in the other and believe enough in the other. And that's how the most interesting things can happen at the Venn diagram of both.
Great. And if you want to look at other startup ideas, including the startup ideas I mentioned around proof of physical work, you can go on our website at alliance.xyz/ideas, and you can go through the list of different ideas that we have listed there.
Imran, what are you excited about? What is a new proof of physical work network that you want to see?
I think health data was like my number one. Number two is energy. Mm-hmm. Obviously, energy, it's a very tough problem to solve. There are a few founders that we're talking to today. But primarily, like if you think about how we consume energy, it's done in a very traditional fashion, right? You have like these large energy providers like ComEd and et cetera that either mine coal or other types of energy resources. nuclear, et cetera. And what they do is they end up, they distribute that energy through like a power grid, and they have, you know, houses that are connected to this power grid. And then they essentially sell energy directly to end consumers. And it's very pricey because really there aren't many energy providers that are out there, and it's primarily a monopoly. It's one mm-hmm. of two.
In many countries, it's nationalized.
It's nationalized, exactly. And so that's like one, right? And so there are countries that are out there that are susceptible to what I call like, they're susceptible to like natural environment dangers, right? So if something goes wrong, like an example is like Germany, right? A lot of their natural gas comes from Russia, like mm-hmm. geopolitically. And so there was a point where Germany could have no energy for X amount of time. Mm-hmm. So there is this like beholden or this like gatekeeper that could be very political, or it could be naturally driven through natural resources. So there is a worry about that for people that want to be completely off the grid as well. So there are many different variables that are involved. One is like, it's very expensive and it's provided by one of two monopolies, and it's very political, or it's by natural resources. So what do you think could happen next with proof of physical work? Well, this is interesting. One idea or one concept is using solar energy, right? So you install solar panels and an energy monitoring system, and you get paid in tokens for sharing the data of your home health or home energy consumption. Mm-hmm. And then also, how much of that excess energy can you sell back to the grid? Obviously, selling back to the grid is very expensive. There's transportation costs that's involved. That's very, very expensive. So I don't see that idea coming into fruition today. But there isn't the ability for this network provider to start to build out their own solar energy farms or industrial farms. And these industrial farms could provide, from the protocol fees, could provide energy consumption as well. And people get paid in tokens. And those tokens provide more resources for these large companies to build out their own industrial farming solar panels. And then there's a second idea of like decentralized energy from peer-to-peer or home-to-home energy provisioning. So an example of this is I have a solar panel and I'm completely off the grid and I produce excess energy. Well, I can connect my house to another house that's next to me, and that person can purchase energy from me directly, and I get paid in tokens or whatever, or the protocol establishes that relationship, and I can provide energy to the house next to me and the other mm-hmm. house next to me. Mm-hmm. So those are like the two things that I'm thinking about, which is like home health data, which is like energy consumption, and then being able to provide energy either to the grid or to houses next to you.
Obviously, I'm not an expert in the solar stuff. You're far more of an expert. You've driven a Tesla for like 5 years. But it feels like the first idea is easier to implement because all you need is some kind of monitoring device that you can install. It's probably not very expensive. And it's basically also data, using tokens to bootstrap data.
Yeah.
It seems fairly straightforward.
And the data can come from like APIs or from like Nest or Tesla. And you can pipe in all of your data, like devices that you have in your house, into the single API that goes into this monitoring unit. It could probably be software-based too, to a certain extent.
Yeah.
And then the data would go to this company, and the company can start to give you tokens. Yeah. And then an example of this is you could see carbon emissions, right? Like how much of this house is producing carbon emissions? Yeah. And could that data be used as a way to, Tesla could find customers for their solar panels. And maybe some of that tokens could offset the cost of solar panel purchase. Because right now, I just did an estimate to figure out how much solar panels would cost in my house. It's like $35,000, and the payback is like 15 years, right?
15?
15 years, 10 to 15 years, depending on how many panels I can squeeze onto my roof. Mm-hmm. And that's only going to offset 60% of my consumption. Right? So I think there is an element of using a token model as a way to pay for some of the cost of the solar panels, keeps people more green. And then maybe in the long run, you could even buy carbon offsets, right? A part of the emissions, you can repurchase carbon offsets as a way to be more green. So there are some interesting experiments that we could run with this idea.
Mm-hmm. Still goes back to one of the earlier points that I mentioned, which is that on the supply side, it's the consumers that bootstrap this network of data. And then on the demand side, the buyers of the data are enterprises who are interested in using this data to whether to sell new products or to balance the energy grid or et cetera.
Yeah. So I do think and agreed, like the thesis, I think that people are going to see, but it's going to be much later. Like I think when the next bull market or whenever starts, people are going to start to see this, which is proof of physical work is going to be a not for certain, but it could be the third wave for crypto adoption. I mean, if you just think about like cell phones, right? I mean, everyone uses a cell phone today and everyone complains about how expensive their plans are. I mean, all you need is 100,000 people, right, using Helium as a mobile device and service, and that can be become very competitive for larger wireless providers. And that brings on 100,000 more users. So I see this being more generalizable, and I see this being an easier way to get into the real world. And there's this always like talk about when is crypto going to have real world adoption? And I think this could be it. Well, great episode. Really enjoy talking about proof of physical work. I think this is a topic you and I both share a lot of interest in. And we're starting to see more and more founders are building in this space. Thanks for tuning in to episode 11. If you have any questions, feel free to reach out. Otherwise, hit the subscribe button and we'll chat with you guys soon. Thanks.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks for listening to Good Game. Don't forget to subscribe. We'll see you next week.